Welcome to Radio Naturopath, the talk show about health and natural medicine. This show will first be broadcast on Wednesday, November 19th, 2025, on 91.7 FM WHUS Stores. I am Fran Storch, ND, naturopathic physician, with my co-host Ron Meniza for the first time in a long time. We're coming to you live from beautiful Mansfield Hollow, Connecticut. Comment below to let us know you're here and ask questions. You can also email me at radionaturopath@gmail.com. If you'd like to listen to the show at another time, you can check out our podcast at whus.org, iTunes, Spotify, Patreon, and Buzzsprout. You may also watch the recorded Facebook Live episode at Fran Storch ND for 30 days, and also on my YouTube channel at Radio Naturopath. The views expressed on this program do not reflect the views of the staff, management, or licensee of this station. The information presented on the show should not be construed as medical advice or direction. If you're having a medical condition, please consult with your physician. In terms of my health, we're moving along, we're moving slow. I went to see the APRN at the neurosurgeon, and she said, you're moving along fine. Don't expect the nerve to be all better in 2 months. It might take more like 5 or 6 months. So I'm able to move. I'm able to get on a trainer bike for half an hour. I could probably go longer. It's just a matter of how pinchy that nerve will feel afterward. So the pain that I have now is not anywhere near as terrible as it was when I was acutely flared. But I do have pressure and nerve sensations and paresthesia on that left side of my thigh and sometimes on my left leg. And I still have pressure in my back, although my back pain, and I have very little back pain now. The incision pain is much, much better. And when I sit for a while, I don't really have incision pain like I did when I first had the surgery. So that's good. So that's moving along. I do have some knee discomfort. My knee was flared and now it's much less flared. I can see that there's effusion. That means there's some fluid on that knee. And I'm going to go see a minimally invasive knee physician in a few days. And so I'll report back on how that goes. And so he does minimally invasive stuff. So he does different kinds of injections of different substances. And I'll tell you what the substances are. The place is called Stem Cell Research. So maybe they put in some stem cells. I don't know. Or they do PRP. Or anyway, we'll see what it is. I'll report back on that. I did speak to somebody who had knee problems and had PRP and was very happy with the results. So that's good to know. I just want to be back on my bike. We're both really impatient. And then as far as Ron goes, Ron is here. So he can tell you how he's feeling these days. How are you feeling these days?
Out of shape. Pretty out of shape.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you think it's out of shape or is there still compression in your neck that hasn't quite healed?
No, I know it's out of shape.
That's all it is?
If you take a look at it, the factors involved here. When I first started having problems with the response in my legs and I was having the power issue.
Yeah.
Right? That was well over a year ago.
Yeah.
Like maybe more like a year and a half ago.
Yeah.
So that started restricting me from riding my bike outside up hills because I couldn't climb the hills anymore.
Right.
So I lost a lot of muscle mass is what happened.
Yeah.
And then when we finally put our finger on it and figured out what was going on and that it wasn't anything cardiovascular, it was neurological.
Yes.
And then I was told, please don't ride your bicycle on the road because we don't want you to fall and, you know, that because it could be the end of Ron. So I stopped riding my bike on the road. I just rode indoors, but my power, even on the indoor bicycle, had dropped by over 100 watts.
Yeah.
If not more. Yeah. So my legs basically fell out of shape because I had no way of using them or the rest of my body at any level of intensity for like a year and a half, almost longer, even longer. And then when I had the operation done, which was good because they cleared up and opened up my neck so that now I have spinal fluid and I have response, I'm still, my legs are just extremely tired and weak, very, very weak.
Are they improving?
Not really, because I'm not really doing what I need to do to improve them. So what I really need to do, and not just my legs, but also the rest of my body too, is I need to spend the winter in the weight room.
Yeah, so when you get on the trainer, when you do your spin classes, you're not able to gradually increase your power on that?
I am, but it's a slow process because I'm really, really out of shape. I've never been this out of shape in my entire life.
Wow.
And, you know, not to mention there's an age factor here.
Yes.
You know, I am 39 years old with 31 years worth of experience.
For sure.
But, you know, there is an age factor involved too, and you definitely lose muscle mass as you get older.
And then building it back takes longer.
Building it back takes a lot longer.
Yeah.
And I've really got to go by how much I can push and how much I'm allowed to push. Right now I'm at 20 pounds.
Right.
So, you know, I've got that. I'll know more in December. And
20 pounds where?
I'm maximum weight I should lift.
That you should lift.
Is 20 pounds right now.
Yeah.
According to my spinal doctor, my spinal surgeon.
Right.
He says he doesn't want me doing any more than that.
Right.
I've done more than that, but I'm very cautious when I do.
Yeah.
I feel like I have enough strength to do more than that, but they just really don't want me to aggravate all the work that's been done.
Right.
And I'm only 3.5 months out, almost 4 months out.
That's true. It's not it's sort of not a lot. It feels like a long time, but it sort of isn't.
It feels like forever because I've really missed two complete cycling seasons.
Yeah.
And because I've missed two complete cycling seasons, I have to start all over again.
Yeah.
It's like I'm a newbie.
Yeah, pretty much.
Except for having some muscle memory and also obviously memory of how to train.
Right.
I'm pretty much, you know, back to square one. Mm. So that's where I'm at. And eventually, you know, like I said, this winter, I'm just going to focus on it. I'm going to do leg presses and I'm going to do squats and I'm going to try to get legs back there. But again, I'm restricted as to how much weight I can use.
Yeah.
So I've got to wait until the doc says, you know, you can now go up to X amount of weight and, you know, we'll take it from there. But we don't want to pull any of these screws out. That's the
right
point. And I did talk to, there's someone that I work with at the town hall whose husband went through this and he broke a screw.
How do you do that?
Because he pushed too soon. So you can, you know, you can do damage to what the repair work that they did. And she said he is a year out of having this surgery done, a little over a year, and he complains to her that he feels very weak all the time.
Oh, no.
So, you know, this is going to be a long process.
Oh.
So,
what are you going to do? You had to do it.
I'm not going to be the guy that my old friend Russell Marin said, this guy with these little skinny legs used to kill us on the hills all
right.
the time. I'm not going to be that guy for a very long time, if ever, again.
Well, you don't know. It could come back.
I would like that.
Look at Ed Saunders.
Well, yeah, I know. But here's the difference between me and Ed Saunders. Ed Saunders never stopped riding his bike.
Yeah.
He never stopped being strong on his bike. And because of that, he continues to ride really strong.
Yeah.
And that's encouraging because, you know, I could get back to that level.
Yeah.
But I think it's going to take me at least a year or two to get back to where I was before I started having the, what the heck is going on with my legs? I'm losing wattage. I'm losing power. I think I got a long ways to go before I get there.
I'm sorry.
Yeah. So you asked. I
did. It's true. Yeah.
But that's my evaluation right now. And I, you know, we'll see where it goes.
Yeah.
I'm not sure. Not sure.
Oh, here's hoping.
Mm-hmm.
Here's hoping. So hoping it's just a matter of you're not fit and that you're going to gain back the fitness. And it's not that there's some permanent nerve damage or that you still actually have healing to do. Then you still have fluid. And because I know what Tamika told me is I still have fluid in my back.
Right.
That it's not that the fluid stays there for a while, and that's one of the reasons I still have discomfort and pressure.
Right.
And that takes a while because there's still healing going on.
Right.
So,
well, I'm sure there's a lot of healing going on because they told me it would take a year to a year and a half to completely heal.
Right.
From this.
Yeah.
So, you know, I just have to be patient, which I'm not good at.
No, I know.
And but you know, there's a light at the end of the tunnel.
Yes, let's hope.
Until the next dark tunnel comes along.
Oh, I hope you're right. My goodness.
This aging process is a professional sport.
It's a professional sport. It's like I can't stand every Wednesday I have another appointment.
Oh.
I have
it's
and I,
ridiculous.
Today I have physical therapy with young Will. Hey, Will. Will is lovely. He's a 25-year-old young physical therapist at Select, and he's very good. He gives me lots of exercises. He's very nice. Mm-hmm. He's a nice young man. He's young enough to be my son.
Yeah, well,
but
they
he's
all
great.
Are now, friend.
I know. No, I think Mary is. Mary's probably closer to my age, but Will is not. And
yeah.
Dave Hoyle is older than us, too. Or probably not. He's probably my age.
Not older than me. I'm older than Dave.
Yeah, I think Dave is my age. Yeah.
He's right about your age,
yeah.
Actually.
Yeah.
He's almost exactly your age, I
no,
believe.
No, I have to look. I'll check. So, and I went to see my naturopath, and she said that I still have some Lyme antibodies, that they're much better than they were, but I should treat for another 6 months. And I haven't been taking the Lyme herbs, and I took a bunch of them all at once after she told me to, and I felt awful right after that. So the next night I didn't do that. So I'm trying to figure out slowly what I can take and what I feel okay taking. And right now I'm just taking Teasel and Cordyceps sometimes. But the Teasel I seem to be tolerating. Cordyceps, I don't know. And then we're going to try to add each herb back in and see how I feel. So. Then I have that. And then she said I have a lot of spike protein antibodies, although that was many months ago, and she wants to retest those. And she wants me to go back to the FLCC protocol of doubling up on my NAC, N-acetylcysteine, and I'm taking black cumin seed oil anyway. I'm taking at least a teaspoon of black cumin seed oil, so that's good. And doubling up on the quercetin, I'm already taking a couple times a day. And there was one nattokinase she wants me to take twice a day. I don't know if I'm going to do that because it's just so much stuff.
It's a lot of stuff. And even what you have me on, it's a lot of stuff.
It's a lot of stuff.
It's a lot.
And you get tired of it.
You do. And you get tired of having to try to swallow all these pills.
Pills,
and,
I know.
You know it just gets to be mildly annoying.
Right.
But, you know, and it's hard to stick to it because of that.
Yeah.
You can see how people fall off of it.
Absolutely.
You know, very easily.
They get sick of it, or they go on vacation and they stop. And
Right.
That's what happened to me. I stopped taking my Lyme herbs when we were in Chicago in April.
Right. And, you know, I'm going to be in Chicago in another week. I'm going to be out there for a long weekend. Yeah, I'm going to make it. It's not going to be a problem.
Well, we hope so.
Yeah, they say that if it's a, they said if it's a trip of that length that you should probably not drive. But if it's like a lesser trip, like 600 or 800 miles, they say drive your car right now.
Isn't Chicago about that?
No, it's like, well, I don't know.
You should check.
It's like a 12-hour.
I know. It's a 12-hour drive.
12-14-hour drive,
yep.
If you don't see traffic.
Right. Right.
So, yeah.
It might be about that. You should check how many miles it is.
Yeah. But I'm not doing it.
You're not
going to
drive. You're going to fly. We'll just hope that you don't get stuck anywhere, that you don't get stuck on this end or the other end.
Yeah.
Yeah.
If I do, then I'll deal with it.
Yeah. You'll eat airport food.
Yeah. Oh, yuck.
So. All right, so that's what's going on with our health. Let's talk about some things that can be helpful to you. Let's talk about vitamin P. Do you know what that is?
I am almost afraid to guess, but
go ahead. It's not what you might think. It's just, I don't know why it's called P, because vitamin F is something else. They're using F for something else, like folate or something. No, that's like vitamin B9. But they're using vitamin F for something else, I think. But vitamin P is just bioflavonoids, and they're really good for you. And here's why. Here's a whole bunch of bioflavonoids and what they are. Okay, so it was once used for a group of plant compounds called flavonoids, but they're not vitamins. They're not vitamins, really. There are several types of flavonoids that are found in fruits, vegetables, tea, cocoa, wine. They give certain foods their color, provide plants with protection from ultraviolet rays and you, and also infection, and have other health benefits. So here's what vitamin P is all about. They're also called bioflavonoids. Ah, This is why. Because they are polyphenols. That's why. So that's where the P comes from. So it's not anything naughty. It's just polyphenols. Polyphenols are, it's a, phenolics are, that's just, it speaks to the structure, the organic structure of the molecule. That's what a phenol is. So anyway, so polyphenols, they have six subclasses, and there's 6,000 known flavonoids. Did you know that? That's pretty cool. The first flavonoids were extracted from oranges by scientists in 1930. They thought it was a new type of vitamin and so called it vitamin P, but the name is no longer used because they're not vitamins. So I'm not sure what makes something a vitamin or not. One of the things that makes something a vitamin, well, I was going to say it, that make a vitamin is essential, but that's not true because vitamin D is a vitamin and it is not essential because your body makes it. Although we don't get enough of it in Connecticut because it's drab and dreary. Look at that, drab and dreary for a lot of the year. So we don't make enough. So we have to eat it and take it. So flavonoids exist in plants to protect against infection, the sun, and environmental stressors. Therefore, it can help you with those things. It also attracts insects for pollination. It's the pretty color, and maybe the insects know something. You know, they know that these are good for them. And they're responsible for the color of deep-colored fruits and vegetables, berries, cherries, and tomatoes. So here are the six kinds of flavonoids. First of all, there's flavanols, and they're the most abundant source of flavonoids in the diet. I'm learning right along with you. I mean, some of these things I kind of know, but this is a good review. So there's camphorol, quercetin, myrcetin, and fisetin. These compounds were found in olive oil, berries, onions, kale, grapes, tomatoes, red wine, and tea. Flavones are widely present in the food supply. They're in chamomile, mint, celery, thyme, and parsley. Then there's flavanols and flavanthriols, and that's where catechins are. And that's epicatechin and epigallocatechin, which are in high concentration black, green, and oolong tea. In the Camellia sinensis plant, that's where you get your EGCG. Flavanols are also in cocoa, apples, grapes, and red wine. Then there's flavanones, and they are in citrus fruits. And they're responsible for the bitter taste of orange, lemon, and other citrus peels. That's where you get most of the bioflavonoids. So if you really want to get bioflavonoids from your food, it's a good idea to get organic citrus and great organic citrus into any food, that it will taste good. An organic citrus peel can be nice in drinks. You don't often want to eat it, but you can candy it, which is not the best thing for you, but you can candy it. You can grate it into any kind of food. It's great on savory things. You can put it over fish. You can make recipes over chicken and other animal protein. And you can grate it into beverages and into desserts. So citrus bioflavonoids include hesperidin, naringenin, which is high in grapefruit, and also ariodictyol. By the way, naringenin is the bioflavonoid that slows down your phase one liver detox, which is why they tell you don't drink grapefruit juice when you're taking certain drugs. If drugs are excreted through certain pathways, naringenin slows those down, and that's why they tell you not to drink it. And people are like, I never want to touch grapefruit, I'm on this drug. You can touch grapefruit. It's okay. You just don't want to have grapefruit every single day or have a big 16-ounce glass of grapefruit juice. But if you have a little glass of grapefruit juice every few days, you're probably going to be fine. Also, if you have half a grapefruit, like you buy a grapefruit this week, you have half of it on Monday and half of it on Thursday, and then you don't have it the rest of the week, you're probably going to be fine. I love grapefruit. I like grapefruit anything. I love to eat actual grapefruits, grapefruit-flavored stuff, grapefruit sorbet. I'm a fan of the grapefruit. I haven't had a grapefruit in a while. I think I'll get one. I'll get one. Then there are isoflavones. The best known isoflavones are genistein and diazin. And those are in soy and soy products. And they are also in red clover. It doesn't say the red clover here, but it's definitely in red clover. And those genistein and diazin are phytoestrogens. And they, in higher concentrations, they can help you with the symptoms of menopause or other female-related discomforts like PMS, premenstrual syndrome, premenstrual dysphoric disorder. And also, you know, if you have sore breasts, if you have, you know, if you have sore, you get sore, swollen breasts before your menses. If you have periods that are off, isoflavones can help with that. Then there are anthocyanidins, among my favorites. They're the they're very pretty because they're dark. Red, blue, and purple fruits and vegetables get their color from anthocyanidins. So you're talking about delphinidin, which is going to be in delphinium, and which is a pretty purple flower. Cyanidin. So I think that the compounds that are related to them are actually toxic. Cyanide is toxic, and the compound in delphinium is toxic too. But cyanidin and delphinidin are not. And peonidin, they're in cranberries, strawberries, blueberries, blackberries, grapes, and red wine. All right. And so those are the major classes. They have all kinds of health benefits. And they help to prevent cardiovascular disease, diabetes, and other diseases. So one of the things I try to get people to do is if they're taking a vitamin C supplement, get one with bioflavonoids in it. I take a vitamin C supplement with bioflavonoids in it. I also eat lots of flavonoids because I have berries pretty much every day. And so they didn't mention pomegranate. There are flavonoids in pomegranate too. And I have a pomegranate sitting on the counter waiting for me to cut it and eat the little arils. All right. So most research on the benefits of flavonoids are conducted in test tubes, so they're not entirely sure what it does in your body, and it's generally thought that they're poorly absorbed and not super bioavailable, and that your metabolism largely influences the bioavailability of flavonoids and may be rapidly excreted. When they're consumed, they're broken down into compounds called metabolites. Some of the metabolites can exhibit properties similar to those of the flavonoid from where they were derived, but others don't. What's more, studies suggest that whether flavonoids are consumed with carbs, protein, or fat can affect their bioavailability and absorption. And those factors affected by the composition of your gut bacteria, so it's difficult to determine how and whether a particular bioflavonoid affects your health. Even though there are limitations, there are some studies that suggest that flavonoids have possible health benefits. So for brain health, cocoa flavanol suggests that they may protect brain cells. So you know how you're eating that raw organic cocoa powder that you're putting in your smoothies or your... Yeah.
I do.
So that raw organic cocoa powder is giving you some brain health stuff. It protects cells, boosts your brain health.
You certainly need that.
Likely via interactions with cell signaling pathways involved in cell survival and memory. For diabetes, there was a study that found that a high dietary intake of specific flavonoids was associated with a lower risk of type 2 diabetes. For every 300 milligrams of flavonoids you get daily, your risk of diabetes decreases by 5%. Then cardiovascular disease. There's 14 studies in humans that these guys looked at and showed the intake of certain classes of flavonoids like flavanols, anthocyanidins, proanthocyanidins, flavones, and flavone-3-ols were associated with a significantly lower risk of heart disease. While results from some observational studies suggest that flavanols may help protect against disease, you got to do more research to fully understand how they work. So dosing and supplements, there's no dietary reference intake as they're not considered essential for human development. Maybe that's the definition of a vitamin. It's considered that the vitamin you need the vitamin to live. You need the vitamin in order to be healthy. But that hasn't been established for flavonoids. They're not considered essential for human development. So if you have healthy whole foods in your diet, they're naturally going to contain flavonoids and contribute to your good health. So supplemental versions are unnecessary but do exist. Some of the most common flavonoid supplements include flavonoid complexes, rutin, and quercetin. So there's no standardized dosage for flavonoid supplements, and each kind may have specific instructions for use. The side effects and dangers are not known. There's generally no risk of toxicity from the amount of flavonoids commonly consumed with food. There could be risks associated with high-dose supplements. So high doses of flavonoids may negatively affect thyroid function, interact with medications, and affect levels of other nutrients in your body. So if you're taking a bioflavonoid and you're on thyroid medicine, for example, you want to make sure you're checking your thyroid levels to make sure that they're staying stable. So supplements aren't tightly regulated by the FDA, of course, can be contaminated. So that's why it's good. If you're concerned about contamination or quality, that's why you should be getting them from a professional source. If you get them from a professional who carries good quality supplements, you're more likely to get high quality supplements. Many research studies have shown that when you eat whole foods that contain certain nutrients, they offer greater benefit than supplement form counterparts. And you want to always talk to your friendly local naturopath, your nutritionist, or someone who is proficient in the use of flavonoids before you use them. So they used to be known as vitamin P. They're in deeply colored fruits, vegetables, cocoa, tea, and wine. And they are antioxidants that can help protect against chronic diseases, but the beneficial effects may be limited by metabolism. There's definitely good studies on various bioflavonoids for various uses. If you want to get flavonoids, it's a good idea to eat a variety of plant foods. You can take supplements, but consult your healthcare provider. And just in general, eat whole foods, please. You're always going to hear that from me. So that's bioflavonoids. Now we're going to talk about saffron. Saffron is popular. It's popularly used in a variety of supplements, and it can be helpful for you. So saffron is pretty impressive. Saffron is antioxidant, anti-inflammatory, and even has anti-cancer benefits. But if you're pregnant, you should avoid high doses. It's also pretty expensive, so it can be hard to have access to it because harvesting it is labor intensive. So it's harvested from Crocus sativus. So it's related to the crocus. It's the saffron crocus. And it's called saffron because it has thread-like structures. And if you look at, I have a bowl of saffron in front of me, which a picture of a bowl of saffron, and it's kind of stringy looking. Saffron's original origin is debated. It's been used for over 4,000 years for its medicinal properties. So what's good about it? Well, it has an impressive variety of plant compounds. They can be antioxidants, molecules that protect your cells against free radicals and oxidative stress. The antioxidants in them are crocin, crocitin, saffronel, picrocrocin, and camphorol. Crocin is the most notable antioxidant in saffron. It gives it its red color and suggests it may have antidepressant properties and might protect brain cells against progressive damage. Research shows that saffronol may have benefits for some health conditions like asthma, inflammation, cancer, hypertension, and depression. And then camphorol is in saffron flower petals, which may boost your immune system and protect your body against several viruses, including influenza, HIV, respiratory syncytial virus, which is that RSV that everybody's talking about that gives you a bad bronchitis, and also hepatitis B. Saffron may improve your mood and treat depression. It's nicknamed the sunshine spice. Part of it is because of the color, but also because it may help to brighten your mood. There was a review in 2019 that found that saffron was significantly more effective than placebo at treating mild to moderate depression. There are other studies that found that saffron was just as effective as fluoxetine, also known as Prozac, imipramine, and citalopram, which is Celexa. Conventional treatments that are used for depression, and fewer people experience side effects from saffron than from those other treatments. This needs to be studied more. It may have cancer-fighting properties because it's high in antioxidants, which can help neutralize harmful free radicals. Free radical damage has been linked to chronic diseases like cancer. And there was a study in 2020 that found that saffron and its compounds have been shown to selectively kill cancer cells or suppress tumor growth while leaving healthy cells unharmed. And the research applies to a number of cancers. They are breast cancer, lung cancer, prostate cancer, cervical cancer, leukemia, brain cancer, and colorectal cancer. Crocin, which is the main ingredient in saffron, may make cancer cells more sensitive to chemotherapy. So that needs to be studied. It may reduce PMS symptoms. I've actually had women with PMS come in and say, "Hey, I read that saffron can be helpful. What do you think?" So now I'm looking for saffron supplements that might be helpful for them. So PMS, or premenstrual syndrome, is a term that describes physical, emotional, and psychological symptoms that occur before starting your menstrual period. And there was a review in 2024 that found that saffron may positively affect multiple parts of the female reproductive system, which could provide relief from PMS. But talk to your healthcare practitioner about this. It may have aphrodisiac properties. Yeah. So those are supplements that help that boost your libido. So studies have found that saffron may have aphrodisiac properties, especially in people taking antidepressants. It was found that in some studies, saffron may help with sexual arousal, satisfaction, genital lubrication, and erectile dysfunction. There was a 2018 review of 6 studies that showed that taking saffron significantly improved erectile function, libido, and overall satisfaction, but not semen characteristics. And then an older study in females with low sex drive due to antidepressants, taking 30 milligrams of saffron daily over 4 weeks reduced sex-related pain and increased sexual desire and lubrication compared with placebo. So saffron may reduce appetite and aid weight loss. Research suggests that saffron may reduce appetite and help with weight management, especially if you have obesity. There was a study in 2023 that found that taking 60 milligrams of saffron per day for 12 weeks was significantly more beneficial than a placebo in reducing body mass index, waist circumference, and weight. Researchers also found that saffron helped improve HDL cholesterol and lower triglycerides. There was a study in 2017 that found that saffron extract supplemented for 8 weeks helped reduce appetite, body mass, waist circumference, and total fat mass. It may reduce heart disease factors. It can help lower LDL, total cholesterol, triglycerides, and blood pressure levels, which could help prevent blood vessels and arteries from clogging. It may lower your blood sugar and raise insulin sensitivity. It may improve eyesight in adults with age-related macular degeneration because it's a great antioxidant. It probably helps with microcirculation, I'm guessing. Eyesight in adults with AMD and protect against free radical damage, which is linked to AMD, may also improve memory in adults with Alzheimer's disease. This is really good. It's really easy to add to your diet. In small doses, it has a subtle taste and aroma and pairs well with savory dishes like paella, risotto, and other rice dishes. The best way to draw out saffron's unique flavor is to soak the threads in hot but not boiling water and add threads to the liquid to your recipe to achieve a deeper, richer flavor. And it's readily available at most specialty markets and can be purchased as threads or in powdered form. It's better to buy the threads if you can because they can be used in many different ways and are less likely to be adulterated. It is pretty pricey, but a small amount goes a long way. You won't need more than a pinch in your recipes, and using too much saffron can give your recipes an overpowering medicinal taste. So don't use too much. It's generally safe with little to no side effects. Doesn't seem to cause adverse effects in humans when you use it in cooking. And as a dietary supplement, people can safely take up to a gram and a half of saffron a day, but 5 grams of more may be toxic. But the effective doses for various things seem to be in the 30 to 60 milligram range. So that's plenty. Pregnant people should also avoid high doses, which has been shown to cause miscarriage in animal studies and maybe toxicity and affect the cervix before pregnancy. And saffron powder is that it can be mixed with other ingredients like beet, red dyed silk fibers, and turmeric and paprika. So if you get saffron, you don't know if it's 100%. You have to make sure that's 100% saffron. So you want to get a reputable brand to make sure you get an authentic product. And if it's too inexpensive, it's probably not real saffron. Or it's probably adulterated. It's adulterated, meaning it could be mixed with other things that are that color. And saffron may help reduce effects of conditions that affect the brain, like depression, Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, PTSD, and epilepsy. It's a powerful spice. It's high in antioxidants. It's been linked to health benefits. May help improve mood, libido, and sexual function, as well as PMS and weight loss. And it's generally safe to add to your diet. So that's exciting. I thought that was nice because saffron is one of the herbs that have flavonoids in it. So I thought it'd be nice to talk about that. And I've been hearing a lot about it. So we're back to menorrhagia. So that's when you have excessive menstrual bleeding. And so we were talking about that for a couple of weeks, and now we want to wrap it up. So here we go. So here's naturopathic treatment for heavy periods. So according to the World Health Organization, over 18 million women between the ages of 30 and 55 seem to have perceived their menstrual bleeding to be excessive. And I see it all the time in my practice. It's alarming how much I see it in my practice, and I have to help people deal with that. Clinical reports demonstrate that 10% of the women experience blood loss severe enough to be clinically defined as menorrhagia, which is defined as prolonged or excessive menstrual bleeding that occurs at regular times of each month with a blood loss greater than 80 milliliters per menstrual periods and may have a flow lasting longer than 7 days. A normal menstrual period should have a flow of about 25 to 80 milliliters and can last like 3 to 7 days. And there are many causes of excessive menstruation, including uterine fibroids, polyps, endometriosis, endocrine imbalances, trauma, infections, other disorders, including cancer. The term dysfunctional uterine bleeding is defined as excessive uterine bleeding that occurs in the absence of an underlying medical condition or structural abnormality. It can only be used when the other causes of it have been ruled out. DUB can occur at any age, but is most common in adolescents and perimenopausal women when your hormones are trying to when you're coming up, your hormones are trying to regulate themselves, and when you're in perimenopause, you're losing hormones. So approximately 20% of DUB cases are adolescents after the first menstrual cycle, and these causes can be they have an immature endocrine system, most notably an immature hypothalamus. Perimenopausal women account for about 50% of DUB patients because of decreasing ovarian function. You just don't have the progesterone to hold the uterine lining together. So the remaining 30% fall into women between ages 20 and 40 and are often due to polycystic ovarian syndrome, emotional stress, athletic training, elevated prolactin levels, or anorexia. So there are 4 subcategories of DUB. So DUB isn't just menorrhagia. There's menorrhagia, metrorrhagia, menometrorrhagia, and intermenstrual bleeding. So we're going to talk mostly about menorrhagia, which is just the excessive menstrual bleeding. In the U.S., statistics show that anywhere from 10 to 20% of women suffer from menorrhagia. However, it's likely the percentage may be higher. Many women experience periods heavy enough to qualify as menorrhagia, but consider it to be normal, commonly because their mother or some other woman in their family had it. And women can often be embarrassed to talk about the fact that they have menorrhagia. Women may have menorrhagia for years and only seek treatment if it becomes so extreme that they can't function normally, or once they're ready to have children. So it's a good idea to get a handle on the condition earlier rather than later, as some of the causes of menorrhagia can be obstacles to conception, and prolonged DUB can very easily lead to anemia. And it's the most common cause of anemia in premenopausal women. So when I get a CBC back, a complete blood count, which is where we measure your number and size, if we see anything close to anemia, I always look to see in their history if they have heavy menstrual bleeding, because that's usually why. So one of the most common signs of having menorrhagia is soaking through one or more sanitary pads or tampons every hour for several consecutive hours. So menorrhagia is defined as blood loss greater than 80 milliliters. So if you have a Diva cup, which is it's one of those cups that you can insert, if you have to change it twice in a day and it's full both times, you've already reached 60 milliliters. One more change with a full cup has put you over 80 milliliters. If you're using a super tampon, which holds 0.3 to 0.4 ounces, so 3 saturated tampons per ounce, which would be 6 per quarter cup, and then a Supla Plus tampon, which holds 0.4 to 0.5 ounces, 2 saturated tampons. If you're saturating a pad every hour, then you're probably bleeding too much. If you need to use double sanitary protection to control your menstrual flow, or wake up to change sanitary protection during the night, if you bleed for a week or longer, if you pass large blood clots, if you have to restrict daily activities because of heavy flow, and if you have symptoms of anemia such as tiredness, fatigue, or shortness of breath. And there's a common finding with menorrhagia: when you pass blood clots, there are varying medical perspectives why you pass clots. One is that the clots form if blood accumulates faster than the body's ability to transfer it from the uterus through the cervix. As it pulls in the uterus, clots will form. Other theories that the body releases anticoagulants during a woman's period that are designed to keep the blood from clotting. If the flow is heavy, it may be expelled too rapidly for the anticoagulants to work, resulting in the formation of clots. So many women experience clots during their period. That doesn't mean you have menorrhagia, but if you're noticing clots during your period, you want to mention the size and amount. If they're very big and there's a lot of them, you could have menorrhagia. So here's dietary suggestions. You may want to make some dietary changes, and you want to make, so basically when you eat whole foods, your menorrhagia is going to be better, because whole foods are going to have phytoestrogens in it and fiber that help give you a good gut flora that's going to help to control your hormones. So you want to eat vegetables, fruit that's high in vitamin C, whole grains, legumes, fish that's high in omega-3 oils, nuts, seeds, and iron-rich foods like brewer's yeast, wheat germ if you're not wheat intolerant, and blackstrap molasses. Reduce your saturated animal fat like beef, chicken, and dairy to support good prostaglandin formation. That doesn't mean don't eat those. It means that if you're eating beef and chicken, make sure it's grass-fed or free-range and it has good quality fats in it. And dairy, it depends. The thing with dairy is that dairy, no matter if it's grass-fed, if it's complete, the animal's completely grass-fed and finished, dairy is always filtered cow's blood, unfortunately. So it can have hormones in it. And if you're sensitive to exogenous hormones, it may affect your menses. So you may have to avoid dairy altogether. But maybe not. If you limit your dairy, first of all, and second of all, only eat grass-fed, completely grass-fed dairy, you might be okay. So eat organic as much as possible, so you're not getting xenoestrogens, foreign estrogen-like compounds, from pesticides or other unfriendly ingredients or fertilizers. Otherwise, you're adding hormones, antibiotics, and other chemicals that can worsen menorrhagia. Eliminate your food intolerances, because they give you inflammation. And if you have inflammation in your body, you're more likely to have menorrhagia. Alcohol, if you consume too much alcohol, that can also increase inflammation and worsen symptoms. So supplements that may be helpful: flavonoids and vitamin C. In healthy women, the integrity of capillaries decreases both after ovulation and premenstrually. So flavonoids and vitamin C enhance your capillary integrity and have been shown to reduce menorrhagia in trials. Bioflavonoids may occupy the estrogen receptor sites in the uterus, so they've got some phytoestrogen activity. So it reduces the estrogen-stimulating effects on the endometrium, because estrogen is going to cause your endometrium to grow more. The more endometrium you have, the heavier your period is going to be. So that could reduce your blood loss. So women who have menorrhagia may need greater amounts of vitamin C and bioflavonoids than the average woman. It also helps in the absorption of iron. So vitamin C supplementation alone has not been shown to be as effective as using it in conjunction with bioflavonoids. And I do give bioflavonoids to women with menorrhagia. So iron, of course, although it's well known that when you have heavy bleeding, it can lead to iron deficiency anemia, it's not as well recognized that iron deficiency anemia can actually cause or worsen menorrhagia. The iron deficiency can cause the muscles of the uterus to weaken, which reduces the ability of the muscles to clamp down on blood vessels, and that's necessary to decrease or stop bleeding. Heavy bleeding may then worsen the iron deficiency, so you want to make sure that you... losing iron because you're bleeding. If you have now lost iron, you're going to bleed more. So you need the iron to help the muscles of your uterus and the capillaries to work better. Then there's vitamin A. There's research that shows that a deficiency in vitamin A impairs hormone production and enzyme activity in the ovaries of animals. The mechanism of action of A on blood loss during menstruation isn't clear, but it's shown to have a complex interaction with estrogen. So the administration of estrogen has reduced the serum vitamin A levels of animals. So when women who have menorrhagia have been found to have lower serum levels of vitamin A than healthy women. So a deficiency in vitamin C, zinc, protein, or thyroid hormone can impair the conversion of carotenes to vitamin A, creating a deficiency in vitamin A. And when we supplement women who have heavy periods, that's one that we may give actual vitamin A, not even just beta carotene, but vitamin A. B vitamins, there's studies that show a deficiency in these can cause the liver to lose its ability to inactivate estrogen, which could theoretically result in estrogen excess. Some forms of menorrhagia are caused by estrogen excess, so if you supplement with B vitamins, it may restore your abilities, your liver's ability to properly metabolize estrogen. Then there's vitamin E, which reduces capillary fragility and encourages the production of beneficial prostaglandins. When you take vitamin E, as you've heard me say many times, please get the kind with tocotrienols, not just D-alpha-tocopherol, DL-alpha-tocopherol. Should have tocotrienols in it. And vitamin K. Vitamin K deficiency is pretty rare because you get vitamin K if you eat leafy greens, but some people don't eat a lot of leafy greens. And vitamin K supplementation has been shown to eliminate excessive menstrual loss in women without a known clotting disorder, so maybe wise to include it in a treatment plan. And then ginger. Menorrhagia is believed to be due to an altered prostaglandin 2 ratio, and ginger has been shown to inhibit the enzymes related to the altered ratio, prostaglandin synthesis and cyclooxygenase. Then there's chaste tree. That may be the best known herb in all of Europe for managing hormonal imbalances in women. Acts on the hypothalamus and pituitary glands. It helps to increase LH production and mildly inhibit FSH release. So you have a shift in the ratio of estrogen to progesterone, helping to reduce menstrual flow. So you have more progesterone around. So Vitex has been shown to inhibit the release of prolactin by the pituitary gland, so particularly when you're under stress, which may take, and it can take a while to take effect. Shepherd's persimmon yarrow are also help to reduce excessive bleeding. Flaxseed oil, make sure if you're taking flaxseed oil that you keep in the refrigerator and that it never tastes bitter. Fish oil also should be kept in the fridge, as well as evening primrose oil, because they encourage the formation of beneficial prostaglandins. Sometimes people need to take bioidentical hormones, and they're extracted from wild yam or soybean, are biologically identical to the progesterone in women's body. Natural progesterone substitutes for a lack of progesterone due to insufficient ovarian production, and it's less potent. It's somewhat less potent than a synthetic progestin, which you don't want to take because it doesn't do the same thing as natural progesterone, and there's a greater cancer risk with it. If you're hypothyroid, please treat the hypothyroid. If you don't have enough thyroid hormone, it can be a common cause of menorrhagia, which is included under treatment for DUB because studies have shown that a reduction in menstrual blood loss in women who are treated for hypothyroid, who had normal thyroid results but showed clinical evidence of the condition. So as naturopaths, we might give you thyroid glandulars or herbs that help to support thyroid function as opposed to giving actual thyroid hormone replacement. So then there's Chinese herbs. They can be helpful. So what you would want to do is go to an acupuncturist who knows their Chinese herbs and that they can relate. They can give you a Chinese diagnosis, whether it's deficient qi or deficient blood, and they can give you herbs that help to address whatever Chinese diagnosis they give you. And they can give you acupuncture as well, or cupping. So you can treat with, when you have dysfunctional uterine bleeding, you want to pull out all the naturopathic stops and you want to treat the person as they are. So you can use a lot of different treatments. You can use body mind treatments. You can use some conventional medical approaches. You can use acupuncture. There are conventional treatments, which we've talked about in the past, like NSAIDs, using oral contraceptives. Sometimes people wind up using those and it gives you an artificial period and it clamps down and you don't ovulate, so you don't get a real period, but it will stop the bleeding. IUDs can help too, because they can stop bleeding as well. Dilation and curettage, where they go in and they scrape out the lining of your endometrium and you can start over. If it's really bad, you can get an endometrial ablation where they cauterize the arteries of the uterus and hopefully you don't get a period anymore. You get a much lighter period. And if you're in really bad shape and there and you've tried absolutely everything, you can have a hysterectomy. So whatever you do, you want to make sure that you're working with a qualified healthcare practitioner, that you don't do this on your own, and you, because there can be so many factors, you want to make sure that you're treating all of the factors that may be going on. Everybody is different and everybody has different things going on in their bodies. And so you have to treat, this is another situation where you have to treat the whole person. So there you go. So I think we've adequately wrapped up menorrhagia for now. And if you have menorrhagia, do go and see your gynecologist, and you can also consider seeing your friendly local naturopathic physician. All right, let's wrap up by talking about something sweet. Let's talk about honey, honey. So why is honey good for you? Let's see if I have enough time to talk about the honey. I have a few minutes left, so I want to talk about it. So honey is a syrupy liquid that honeybees make from plant nectar. It's a common ingredient in many foods. It's available in many forms. It has a lot of health benefits. So honey has a lot of nutrients in it. Last night I had a cup of tea and I'm like, I really need to start drinking hot tea that's not Camellia sinensis. So I'm drinking something hot that doesn't have caffeine in it. So I had some turmeric and ginger tea and I added a little honey to it and cinnamon, and it was kind of like drinking chai without the caffeine. It was really nice, and it was nice and warming. It's great for this time of year. So here's what's in honey. A tablespoon is 61 calories, no fat, no protein, 17 grams of carbs, has a little bit of riboflavin and copper. It's basically sugar. It has no fat and trace amounts of protein and small amounts of some nutrients. But most people don't consume enough honey for it to be a significant source of vitamins and minerals. It does, minimally processed honey does have antioxidants in it. And the darker the honey, the more flavonoids it has in it. So if you get a honey that looks like very dark brown or almost black, that the bees that made it were hitting on some flowers that had a lot of bioflavonoids in it. And so it's going to have more antioxidants. It's going to be better for you. The plant compounds, it's going to have flavonoids, phenolic acids. The darker varieties have more antioxidants than lighter varieties, which is what I said. So antioxidants help neutralize reactive oxidant species in your body, which can build up in cells and cause damage. And the damage can contribute to conditions like premature aging, type 2 diabetes, and heart disease. And many of honey's health benefits are attributed to its antioxidant content. It tends to be better for your blood sugar than regular sugar. So honey may offer some slight benefits over regular sugar. Although honey raises your blood sugar level just like other types of sugar, the antioxidants it contains may protect against metabolic syndrome and type 2 diabetes. Researchers have found that honey may increase adiponectin levels, which is a hormone that reduces inflammation and improves blood sugar regulation. There's some evidence that daily honey may improve fasting blood sugar levels in people with type 2 diabetes. So if you have type 2 diabetes, it may actually help you regulate your blood sugar. Honey may be slightly better than refined sugar for people with diabetes. You should still consume it in moderation. And some producers dilute honey with plain syrup. Although honey adulteration is illegal in most countries, it can still be a problem. So you want to get good, raw, local honey. We are very blessed that there are lots of beekeepers in New England, and it's very easy to go to the health food store. And even I'm pretty sure that you can get raw local honey at the supermarket, but you definitely can get it at your health food store, and you can get it at farmers markets. You can buy it at local farms. You can buy it at farm stands as well. Honey may improve your heart health. It may help to prevent heart disease. According to one review, honey may help lower blood pressure, improve blood fat levels, regulate heartbeat, and prevent the death of healthy cells. All factors that can help improve your heart function and health. One observational study, including over 4,500 people over 40, associated a moderate honey intake with a lower risk of blood pressure among women. There was a rodent study that showed that honey helped protect the heart from oxidative stress. That's why the mice are coming in, because we have honey. I'm just kidding. Additionally, raw honey contains propolis, which is a resin that bees produce that from sap-producing trees and similar plants, which may improve cholesterol and triglyceride levels. It's also, it doesn't say this here, but it's a wonderful antimicrobial. It's something that the bees make to prevent infections in the hives. There's no long-term human studies on honey and heart health, but so there needs to be more research. Honey can help promote burn and wound healing. There's a historical precedence for the use of honey for wound and burn healing, and it's still common today. There's at least 26 studies on wound care found it's most effective at healing partial thickness burns and wounds that have become infected after surgery. So Manuka honey specifically may have positive applications in burn treatment, but if you have a severe burn, you don't want to just use home remedies. You really need to go to have emergency care. So researchers theorize that honey's healing powers come from its antibacterial and antimicrobial effects. Honey may help suppress coughing in children. It's a common problem with kids with upper respiratory infections. Also grown-ups, these infections can help affect your sleep quality and quality of life for children and parents. There was a review of several studies on honey and cough in children found that honey appears more effective than diphenhydramine for cough symptoms, which diphenhydramine is an antihistamine. It may also help reduce cough duration. And honey may also improve sleep quality among children with coughs as well as their parents. Further, unlike some cough medicines, honey doesn't have any side effects. Don't give honey to children under a year old because there is a risk of botulism. You can add it to your diet easily. You can use it in any way. You typically use sugar. You can sweeten plain yogurt with it, coffee, tea of any kind. You can use it in cooking and baking. It is a type of sugar, so consuming it will cause your blood sugar levels to rise. So if you eat large quantities of it over a long period of time, it can contribute to weight gain. So if you're eating maybe a tablespoon a day, you're probably okay. So you can use honey to sweeten yogurt, beverages, and ingredient recipes, home remedy for wounds and coughing, but eat it in moderation. So it can help with blood pressure management, cholesterol management, wound healing, cough suppression, polyphenol content, and antioxidant content. There is a study in men and honey, Ronald, of several studies in humans and animals found it may help men with erectile dysfunction by improving erections due to vasodilation effects. It may also improve daily sperm production and lifespan, restore testosterone levels. Most studies in humans are needed to establish the effects of honey consumption on male health. Should you have a spoonful of honey? You should use moderation. It is a carbohydrate. It can raise your blood sugar, but if you eat it in moderation, it has been shown to help with type 2 diabetes. It may work for you as long as you limit all other sugars and talk to your healthcare practitioner about it. All right, I think that's all we can do today. That's a wrap. All right, so I'll be back with you next week. And next week is the pre-Thanksgiving episode, so we'll have it as your companion to making your Thanksgiving goodies. You have been listening to Radio Naturopath, the talk show about health and natural medicine. I am Fran Storch, ND, naturopathic physician, with my co-host, Ron Meniza. You can email me with questions and comments at radionaturopath@gmail.com. If you'd like to listen to the show at another time, you can check out our podcast at whus.org, iTunes, Spotify, Patreon, Buzzsprout, and YouTube. You may also watch the recorded Facebook Live episode at Fran Storch, ND. The views expressed on this program do not reflect the views of the staff, management, or licensee of the station. The information presented on this show should not be construed as medical advice or direction. If you're having a medical condition, please consult with your physician. Thank you for listening to Radio Naturopath, your show where you can learn about the best of science and nature. We'll be back with more Radio Naturopath next week at 91.7 FM, WHUS Stores, and WHUS.org.